This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, Place to Be Nation proudly brings to you its longest-running, weekly, episodic comic book podcast in Place to Be Nation pop history, the fat man Greg Phillips, the bald man Nick Duke, the hard, traveling fanboys. And if you're not down, we got two words for ya. We understand. Welcome back to the hard traveling fanboys, folks.
I am blatantly ripping off the entrance of tag teams you claim to hate.
I don't know what you're talking about. That was all original material.
Of course it was, like everything else you do.
I don't want to hear it from you, the bastion of originality, Nick Duke. That's what they used to call you in school, I heard.
Yes, the BAO, that was my, or the BO.
BOA. BOO, the boo.
The boo.
The bastion of originality.
Indeed.
Yes. Not the bastion of acronyms, apparently, but
not the Bastion Booger either.
No, although he was a good Bastion.
He was
almost as good as Red Bastien, who you can hear on Jim Ross's podcast.
Let's not discuss Red Bastien at length.
We want to talk about the Colonel.
Like I said, let's not discuss Red Bastien at length.
Anyhow, we are glad that you joined us for a very special edition. I really said that in like a seductive Linda McMahon, didn't I? A very special edition of the Hard Traveling Fanboys, because unlike special editions of TV shows, we're not going to talk to you about drug use or abuse or any other thing involving drugs. Instead, we're going to talk to you about obscene amounts of violence, because we are here to give you a spoiler-filled, exclusive Place to Be Nation review of the season 7 premiere of The Walking Dead. That's right, folks. It set ratings records Sunday night. Or maybe not records, but it blew away every other show on television with its ratings Sunday night, as The Walking Dead came back to answer the question, who did Negan kill? Now, as mentioned in the last episode, this is going to be spoiler heavy. So if you don't want to hear any spoilers about this, if you haven't watched the episode yet, highly suggest that you skip ahead to the break, which we will be sure to try and provide you with in these links to let you know about when the halftime break is, so to speak, because we're inverting our formula this week. And we're going to do our normal beginning stuff at the end. We're going to get the review out of the way first. But that's what we've got on deck for you this week.
Absolutely. You said it, Bubba.
Perfect.
We are here. I mean, it's the biggest thing that's happening right now on television and in all of pop culture, I would argue. So we wanted to delve right into it.
That's right.
And
they've actually been talking to us at the airports about it.
Yes, the airports. The airports. And as we'll get into, the airports seem to be giving it quite a mixed reaction here in Bizarro Land.
That's right. And as you know, in Bizarro Land, folks, you have a right to your opinion, even if it's wrong.
Even if it's wrong. That's right. So with all that being said,
Should we talk before we get to that? I just want to say we are changing our formula around because we thought it was time to maybe for this episode shake things up a bit and begin the ruthless aggression era of the hard-traveling fanboys, which is actually going to be exactly like the old era of the hard-traveling fanboys. We're just going to call it something different for branding purposes, and we'll go back to the original formula next week.
Do you ever wonder what it's like for people who aren't wrestling fans to listen to this podcast?
I've wondered it before, but I just don't care.
No, I don't either. I was just, it's just one of those wild tangents you go off on every once in a while where you – you think about, you know, what if you lived in a different
world? What if we lived in a different world where we followed the Cosby Show on weeknights and were a successful comedy for NBC in the early 90s?
Yeah, yeah. Nobody really wants to follow Bill Cosby, or I guess
we don't
want
to.
I guess these days you don't want Bill Cosby following you. More likely,
we don't want to get into any of that.
I don't have an issue with getting into it. We can talk all about the pudding pop.
No. So, what were you saying, Nick? What were you saying before I so rudely interrupted you?
Oh, I don't even remember at this point. You've preambleized so much that my thoughts have fluttered away.
Preambleized. That's an original term too, Nick.
Oh, I'm full of originality, as you said.
The bastion.
We both are.
The boo, Nick Duke. You my boo. Anyway.
Oh God. I guess that's better than bae, so we can at least have that to hold on to.
That's right. And speaking of bays, many people who are fans of The Walking Dead consider their bay to be Negan, in terms of villains at least. So, again, we are prefacing this by saying heavy spoilers ahead, because we're going to get right into the spoilers. I feel, Nick, I don't know about you, that I think the first thing we need to do right out of the way is get out of the way the answer to the question that was asked so frustratingly at the end of last season: who did Negan kill?
Yeah, I suppose that's the place to start. And, you know, to preface this, as Jeffrey Dean Morgan had hinted around in some interviews, a little bit of misdirection here, because it wasn't just one victim, as we had been led to believe by the close of season six. It was actually two shocking deaths that wind up occurring. So I suppose we should take them chronologically. And,
yes, and start with the least shocking, I think, of the two, I would argue.
Yes. Well, I mean, we'll talk about it. So the close of season six saw the camera cheesily go to first person and some cartoon-style James Bond blood run down the camera lens as we were placed inside the head of the person who was being beaten to death by Negan. And here, in this episode, that person was revealed to be Abraham. Greg, your thoughts on Abraham biting the bullet here, so to speak?
Well, I would argue that this was probably the least surprising, because as much as you and I enjoy Abraham, and many people that I know enjoy Abraham as a character, and especially the performance of Abraham on the show, he's not one of the central cast members, and he never has been. He's never felt like he was really a part of that central core group that is close to Rick. And so Abraham, if you looked at his character arc last season, they really brought his character full circle, where, you know, he had his whole redemption arc and he came around and was a helper for the team. And there really didn't seem to be much more left to do with him, except, I guess, pursue the random Abraham Sasha.
Yeah, the very odd Sasha relationship, which, you know, not once again, as we often say here, not to tell tales out of skewl, but if I were, you know, hypothetically speaking, in a relationship with someone like Rosita, I don't think I would be overly eager to get out of it. Certainly not
right
for the benefit of Sasha.
Right. That just blew my mind, why you would ever cheat on Rosita. But, you know, that's neither here nor there, quite frankly. And so it felt like they had wrapped up most of the arcs that could be done with Abraham. So I wasn't terribly shocked that he was killed off. That said, his dying line, his deathbed quote, if you will, just reminded me of why I loved him so much and why I'm going to miss him from the show. When he tells Negan, blood running down his face, skull about to be bashed in, literally, he looks up at Negan and he says to him, "Suck my nuts."
He does indeed. And even Negan himself is charmed by that in a way, because he lets out a great big laugh and kind of gives Abraham some credit for showing some stones there. Now, granted, it's not enough credit to keep him from getting his entire head brutally beaten to a pulp, which we see in gory, gory detail. Yes, we see Abraham's body with naught but pulp hanging off of it at the top. So
yes,
that was the first of our ultra, ultra gory death scenes.
And I don't know about you, Nick, but I'm going to miss Abraham. I'm going to miss what he brought to the show.
I'm absolutely going to miss Abraham. As I've often said, The Walking Dead can be a very oppressively dark and bleak show at times. And it's important to have characters who are capable of lightening that tone from time to time, of making you laugh and breaking some of the tension. And Abraham was one of those characters for me. Arguably one of only, I would say, two characters on the show at this point, or two characters on the show heading into the season premiere that that had that potential. The other obviously being Eugene. And, you know, fortunately Eugene was spared. We can go ahead and say that right now. And yes, if Eugene had been killed, I would have been launching my one-man riot at the homes of Robert Kirkman, Scott Gimple, and whoever the head of AMC is.
Well,
Nicotero is pretty much just the effects guy. Like, I'm not going to hold Nicotero responsible for, you know, for creative decisions, quite frankly. So,
talent executes plays.
Eugene is safe, as you know, and a nation breathes easily.
Let's get into also the structure of the show while we're talking about the early death, because a lot of people were talking about how they were going to be frustrated, us included, if The Walking Dead did not address the frustrating cliffhanger from last year right off the bat in the episode. But most people, I think, expected, given the past of The Walking Dead show and how it treats the fan base, many people expected The Walking Dead to hold off until the end of the episode to reveal whatever deaths there were. And to their credit, they started the episode kind of in a typical Walking Dead fashion, where it's kind of we're already past whatever has happened, and Rick is taken in an RV ride with Negan.
Yeah, we had flashed forward the opening scene. I think we had flashed forward probably something like 5 to 10 minutes of real time for the season 6 cliffhanger. So the deaths there had been skipped over, and we were picking up with the immediate aftermath of what had happened,
right?
And how Rick was dealing with it. And Rick at first was trying to deal with it in true Rick fashion, which was, you know, basically threatening Negan and telling him that he was going to kill him, and that was, quite frankly, not the appropriate response in that situation.
Right, and you know, and to their credit, it took them all of what, maybe one commercial break before we actually got to see what happened.
You know, I honestly can't tell you because I wasn't counting, because unlike what I thought I would, like you said, we all wanted the cliffhanger to be resolved fairly early on, but I think when the show opened, I was so taken with the performances and what was going on that I didn't immediately get upset about not having the cliffhanger revealed to me. Now, I did immediately go, okay, if they didn't do it right here, they're going to make us wait until the end of the show, us wait until the end of the episode. And my wife, who I was watching it with, kept cringing and covering her eyes every time they do a flashback to Negan standing there with the bat or whatever. And I kept telling her, oh, don't worry about it. They're not going to tell you till the end of the episode. And so when it did come, about at the 20-minute mark or so of an hour and 6-minute episode, I was genuinely surprised by the timing of it, that they were actually going all the way and revealing, you know, what happened. And so that was when we got the Abraham death. But no, I wasn't upset at all by the delayed reveal, mainly because I felt like they earned it, because the acting, the performances, the writing leading up to it were genuinely well done and not ham-handed like the cliffhanger was last year.
Yep, and it caught me off guard that they did it when they did it.
Yes,
I kept thinking, yeah. So it, you know, well executed on the part of the creators here. Like you said, and that'll become a theme, I think, of our review of this episode, the acting really carried the day here. The pacing was great. The direction was great. The tension, I actively felt tension the entire episode, which was really important and really key. But I think that is anchored in the acting from Andrew Lincoln as Rick, from all of the cast sitting around, kind of whenever we would see them in that semicircle, just, you know, not really able to talk, just emoting. And then, of course, Jeffrey Dean Morgan as Negan was off the screen.
Pretty much a tour de force, a dynamo performance from that guy. But, you know, we're sitting here praising the acting, and this is something we'll get into a little bit later, but even the acting for a lot of people was a point of divisiveness, a point of contention. This seems to be not, you know, one of the more divisive episodes of The Walking Dead that I can remember in recent memory. I think that the season six finale was pretty much universally reviled for the way they handled it. But this one, yes. I think there's a pretty even mix of people who were impressed by this and people who were turned off by it.
Right. Should we go ahead and get into the second kill and then get into more of the generalizations of the episode?
Yeah, well, I think first we should probably talk about, so, you know, the second kill, a lot of people are saying, well, it had no reason, you know, Negan just randomly decided to kill a second person, and I want to go ahead and address that here. So in the episode, after Negan has killed Abraham and is somewhat, you know, gloating about it, Daryl, our beloved Daryl, actually takes action, stands up, and socks Negan right in the jaw. In a complete Daryl moment. And Negan, rather than killing Daryl, decides to show Daryl what his actions has wrought by turning his barbed wire bat Lucille on Glenn and beating Glenn to death right in front of the rest of the group. And so that's one part that I think a lot of people lost when they complain about the Glenn death being random and nonsensical. It was done as retaliation for Daryl's actions, and I don't see how so many people miss that point.
Yeah, so your contention is that if he just kills Daryl, he doesn't. Because I think that was a question many people have had is, well, if he has a problem with Rick, why doesn't he just kill Rick? Or if he has a problem with Daryl, why doesn't he just kill Daryl? Because it's about sending a greater message that
right.
if you step to me, it's not going to be you that suffers. It's going to be the people around you.
Because clearly at this point, you've seen what's happened to Abraham. If you step to me, you are showing you have no regard for yourself, but you clearly have regard for others. And so how do I hurt you? How do I get you in line? Is not by threatening you. It's by threatening the ones you care about.
Yeah.
I thought that was personally, I thought that was crystal clear, but I guess others did not feel that way.
Right, right. And kills Glenn in absolutely brutal fashion. And full disclosure, as Nick and I have gone back and forth on this for a while now on the character of Glenn, I really turned off of Glenn there in – I can't remember what – the season when they were separated and he and Maggie were searching for each other. I really grew to resent how Glenn was written that season. And so I didn't expect to have any kind of emotional reaction to his death. But I have to be honest, because of how gory it was, I think, and also the performance and how he sold the death and Maggie's selling of the death, it actually did have an effect on me. Like, it was – obviously there's the kind of stomach-churning – you know, it's probably the grossest death they've ever done on The Walking Dead, and I don't think there's anything else even in the running for it.
I would agree, just because it's such a different death. And like, typically when they do deaths on The Walking Dead, it's largely by walker bite or gunshot or something like that. And so it's, you know, we've largely seen variations on the same theme for, you know, 6-7 years now, whereas this one was completely brutal in a new way, a way that we hadn't really been desensitized to.
Right. Seeing Glenn's eyeball popping out of his head was
really... And his skull, like, caved in a little bit.
And him trying to talk and not being able to was really, really hard. So it was it got the reaction that was intended to get, at least out of me.
And as you said, I know you were giving some praise to Steven Yeun for good reason, but I would argue that Lauren Cohen's performance as Maggie was really what sold that death. Her desperation, her anguish in that moment was, I mean, just another example of an outstanding performance in this episode, in my opinion.
Yeah. And so one of the things, I guess, I feel like we're all over the place on this review, but I will go ahead and say that I expect both of us are going to have praise for this episode. I think we both enjoyed it.
Yes.
But the reason I want to go ahead and get out in front of that is I feel like there's a lot of – I feel like part of this review episode is going to be us kind of taking on some of the criticisms of the episode that we've seen, and we've already
Absolutely.
Kind of done that a little bit. And so I want to get into one that I think is a fair one. that is not necessarily as much an indictment on the episode as it is on the show as a whole. I read a piece that was written on actionflickchick.com by Katrina Law, I think is her name. And she's really good. She's written good stuff for years about action movies and the genre. She's followed The Walking Dead for a long time. And her premise is that this was the end point for her, that she's no longer interested in watching the show. And her premise is that the Glenn death, not because they killed Glenn because it was comic book accurate or whatever, but because of last season, the Glenn death was the cutting point for her. Because and this is a fair criticism of last season, season 6 of The Walking Dead was an exercise in audience manipulation from the beginning to the end.
Yes.
Completely. Her argument was the only reason that they did the Glenn death fake out.
Yes.
Was to set up this death.
Yes.
And in her opinion, that is not good storytelling. That is shock value. That is basically manipulating the audience. And I think that is a fair complaint to have.
I agree. You know, here's what I would say to that. It was clear to me at this point, you know, in retrospect, that the Glenn dumpster fake out from last season, which never bothered me as much as it did you, but still I thought it was a little cheesy for the show. It's clear now that it was done to throw people off the scent of Glenn dying, that it was done to make it seem as if Glenn would be safe when this moment rolled around. I would even argue to an extent that you could, you know, look at it as if Abraham's death was done to make it seem as if Glenn was safe.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen that argument made as well. But here's what I would say. You can view Glenn, the moments leading up to Glenn's death, in the context of the show as a whole, and you can also view it in the context of the story they are telling in this particular episode. This episode is a standalone episode. And I would argue that in the context of this episode, it was extremely well done, even if it wasn't necessarily
yes.
well done in the context of the larger narrative, if that makes sense.
You took the words right out of my mouth. This is a situation where we're so of the same mind on this argument, because I agree with you completely. That was going to be my counter to it as well, because I completely – that argument that she put forth – I completely agree with it in the greater context of The Walking Dead as a series. I think that last season was a huge misstep in terms of the overall narrative and in terms of betraying some of what – I mean, and let's be honest, betraying some of what Robert Kirkman's quirks are as a writer. I'm still in on the show, and as long as I'm in on the show, I have to judge it by what it is, not by what it was. And for what it was, for what it is right now, it's very effective. The episode was, for me anyway, was tremendously effective. And now I want to see where these characters go from here, how they can possibly recover from this. Because I wrote this online in a few discussions about this episode. I think with Jennifer as well, we were all talking about this. I said it was maybe one of the most – maybe the most depressing hour of television I've ever watched. Just relentlessly depressing, to the point where you end the episode and – I don't know about you, but I ended the episode and I was like, I don't see any way right now that the heroes can possibly overcome the situation that they're in. Now they will at some point. Hopefully, anyway, but you're left wondering, how are they ever going to recover from that? And some would say, and that this will get to another criticism of the episode, that that's too bleak, that that's too depressing for a popular television show. My argument would be that's fine. I mean, that's the show, for better or worse. Like,
I mean, yeah, exactly. You say it's too bleak for a popular television show, but why is the show popular? Like, it's not. I mean, did this take what the show is and you know, elevate it to an extreme? Yes, but it was a natural extension of the themes and tone that the show has had pretty much since it started. The Walking Dead has never been about you know, the triumph of the human spirit or anything like that.
No.
You know, it is a bleak journey through a post-apocalyptic world where more often than not we are exposed to the worst side of humanity over and over and over again. And so when you have those themes that have been explored for six seasons now, when you have a cliffhanger like season six where you know for a fact that a major character is about to be beaten to death in brutal fashion, and when you have every person involved with the making of the show, whether it be cast members, producers, directors, effects people, in every interview for months saying, this was the most difficult episode we've ever had to film. It was legitimately emotional. It was brutal. It was giving us real emotional pause while we were filming. They're basically screaming at you and flashing neon signs saying, this is not going to be an overly, quote, fun experience. So I really wonder what people were expecting from this. If your complaint is the tone is too bleak, I mean, what were you expecting? What were you tuning in to watch? Because I don't think you were paying attention if you expected anything much different than one we got. Personally.
Yeah, it would, you know, if that episode happened on Supergirl, it would be way out of line, and it would be completely not appropriate for the show. But it's not Supergirl; it's The Walking Dead. The comic book, by the way, has gotten a lot bleaker than that. Has dealt with themes a lot bleaker than death. I'll put it that way. And you know, that's what the property is. And, you know, and again, it's also the first episode of the season. That not every episode is going to be like this.
Right.
Not every episode is going to be relentlessly depressing. But if you follow the arc of The Walking Dead since it started, it's been a depressing show. We've watched Rick turn from what was clearly a genuinely good person in the first episode to the point where he's gone all the way back around to basically being Shane now. And you know, we've seen all of these good – the only character we've seen seem to find humanity in the midst of all this has been Daryl. Everyone right. else has seemingly – other than Maggie and Glenn have seemingly lost their humanity.
Morgan as well.
And Morgan. Morgan had to go back around the bend, yeah. though. Like he
and Morgan wasn't on the show from the get-go, so we weren't
– Precisely.
We haven't seen his full character journey. And as well, you know – a lot of people are complaining because of the like you said, the bleakness, the oppressive tone of it, how depressing it was for our lead characters. I would argue that something like this, it was time for it. It was needed.
Yep.
Like you were saying, Rick and the rest had gone from mostly good people to preemptively murdering, what was it, a dozen people in an episode last season?
Yeah.
You know, members of Negan's group. It mm-hmm. was time for these people to be put in their place. And when you have elevated these characters to such a brutal fashion to where the point where they are desensitized to the world around them, they have to be snapped out of that, and they have to realize that they're not invincible, and that has to be done in equally brutal fashion. And to me, that's what this episode was about showing Rick, you know, where the power lies, so to speak, and it's no longer in the palm of Rick Grimes.
You want to talk about wrestling references? That was an expert one right there. Well played. Yeah.
Thank you.
Well played.
Think I didn't notice Negan's red bandana around his neck. I think we all know. I think we all know where Negan draws his inspiration from.
So we've gotten those kind of arguments out of the way, you know, and I get it. For some people, it was too much, and I'm not going to criticize someone for not right. being able to dig a show where a guy gets his brains beat out.
Absolutely, but I would argue that that's the fault of the person, not the fault of the show. Like, and that's fine. Ultimately, you get to decide where your line is and what your, I guess, your taste or moral compass is. But this was not something out of left field for the show, is what I'm saying. This
right.
is the show.
I agree completely, and in the context of the show, I would put this pretty high on my list of episodes. I thought this was one of the better, maybe the best season premiere since the first one. I mean, off the top of my head, I'm trying.
Yeah, honestly, the show at this point, because they've done so many story arcs that run over seasons, because they've stopped kind of ending stories neatly, you know, with a season end. Mm-hmm. The seasons all start to run together for me, so I'd really have to go back and think about that. But I would say, off the top of my head, it's probably a top 10 episode for the show ever. I'd have to really do some research to go back and see, you know, if it ranks any higher than that, which is a potentially interesting topic for a future show. But, you know, I thought the show, I thought the episode was a big step forward, a return to form in a way, and it gives me hope for season 7 in a way that I didn't have coming into it. Because, like you and I both said, I don't think either of us were going to stop watching the show as a result of this one episode, but I think both of us were closer to being fed up with the show than we had ever been before heading into this season.
Right. The season, statement to make. Yes, the season finale, to use terminology that will be familiar to at least one of our listeners, left bad taste in mouth.
Indeed.
And we were both talking about there was a potential. They could have written this episode in a way that probably would have turned us off. Like, there were ways in this episode. If they had written this season the way that they wrote last season, where they introduce a cliffhanger and then they don't resolve the cliffhanger for 6 episodes into the season, that would have been too much for me, probably.
Right.
Yeah. But thankfully they didn't do that, and the way that they did it had an effect on me in a way that I didn't. When you can get me to reinvest in a character that I had de-invested from prior, that's pretty impressive. They did a good job with that. The acting, again, this is an area that I don't understand the critique. I don't understand a critique of the acting in this episode. I thought they were all across the board tremendous.
I'll give a small shout out in particular. I don't know her name, but the chick who plays Rosita, who has been given practically zero character development since the moment she walked on screen, who has been essentially eye candy, let's be honest. I thought she had one of the best scenes in the entire thing, when you see her anguish and heartbreak over Abraham's death, even though, like, he had been terrible to her in recent, you know, in the most recent episodes. She clearly still loved the guy, like genuinely loved and cared about the guy, and was heartbroken over what had happened, to the point where she's even able to have that little moment with Sasha, who is the woman she knew that had Abraham's heart after the events of last season. It was just a really cool moment for that actress and that character. So,
Christine,
like you said,
Serratos is her name.
Christine Serratos, very good. So, yeah, I mean, all the acting was great, but I think, you know, we've talked about the deaths, we've kind of talked about the criticisms. I think we need to go ahead and, you know, we talked about Lauren Cohen a little bit. So the meat of the episode, though, was essentially one long confrontation between Andrew Lincoln's Rick Grimes and Jeffrey Dean Morgan's Negan. And those were really the two performances that the bulk of the episode hinged on.
Absolutely. And both guys delivered. We make fun sometimes of Andy Lincoln's Rick.
We do, yeah.
And you know, because there are so they put him in some goofy situations sometimes.
It's just so strange because his performance is almost always good, but there are just certain, like, mannerisms or certain moments that just so wildly stand out from his otherwise steady portrayal that it
right.
You can't help but to mock it. I mean,
right, like Coral and stuff Coral. Like that, you know.
Yeah.
But that being said, this was a wonderful reminder of just what a great actor he is. Mm-hmm. He anchored the episode in a way, and I thought it was the best reminder we've gotten in a long time on The Walking Dead of just how much Rick cares for all these people. Because one of the reasons that Rick has become kind of a cooled off character, I think, for the fandom in recent years, is that as he's turned more into Shane and taken on personality characteristics of Shane, he's become colder to the world around him. He's become more, I guess, less connected to those ancillary characters, basically the characters that aren't Carl and Michonne. You know, we didn't really get to see a lot of Rick with Glenn and Maggie and Daryl in recent seasons. And this really showed you how much Rick cares for the entire group, because you could see the anguish on his face. You could see the fear in his eyes, especially the scene – and you may disagree because of how much you hate Carl. But the scene where Rick's is being forced by Negan seemingly to cut off his own son's arm, and the just pathetic whimpering that he's left doing, it didn't come off as goofy. It didn't come off as corny to me. It came off as heartbreaking that
right.
you're seeing that this is a father going through this with his son. And it's just I can't say enough about how good Lincoln was in this one.
Yes, it was extremely heartbreaking that he didn't just grab the axe instantly and do what needed to be done.
Which, by in this case, in your opinion, means not killing Negan, but chopping off Carl's arm.
Or aiming a little higher and up around the head and neck area.
Lopping off his head, if you will.
That would have been fantastic.
And I would argue that
that was the thing. That was one of the few funny moments. Not that it was funny because of what happened on screen, but you know, Danielle and I are sitting there watching the episode, and they're doing the thing where Negan is doing the eeny meeny miny mo thing at each person, and he points at Carl, and I go, "Oh, please God, yes!" out loud, and you know, we both in the room thought that was pretty funny. I was sadly, vastly disappointed when Carl didn't meet Lucille.
I think that they should do a special viewer's choice episode where they can add two more deaths to Negan's kill count, which would be, of course, Carl Grimes from you and Karen Page from Daredevil from me. And he can just bash them both in the head, and they can be gone. And that'll be – and it would be good. Oh, we haven't even mentioned I know we still have to get to Negan, but we haven't even mentioned the heartbreaking fantasy dinner table sequence at the end where you see all the characters sitting around, including the ones that have been killed, sitting around with Glenn and Maggie's unborn baby as a baby, sitting around at the dinner table that Negan has been mocking the crew with throughout the episode, saying, "I know you thought you'd all be sitting around at Sunday dinner with smiles on your faces, but that ain't how it works now." And you see that fantasy scenario where everybody is sitting around. Abraham's alive, Glenn's alive, Maggie's alive, the baby's alive, and they're all sitting around just having...
Which, to mislead people who may not have seen it and are listening to this for whatever reason, Maggie and the baby are both still alive at the end of this episode.
Right, they are, but the baby is already born in this fantasy scenario.
Right.
And my
It's basically a fantasy flash forward to an ideal world.
Right. And my opinion, I have nothing to base this on. I haven't read the comics that far. My opinion is that Maggie is not going to have the baby. Because I don't think they'll want to have two babies on the show. That's just my opinion.
The only thing I could see would be, you know, Kirkman has talked about how as long as the ratings are up, he wants to keep the show going for as long as possible. And I think having kids like Judith and this new kid and, you know, and other characters like Carl and the teenage girl that I've forgotten the name of from Alexandria is a natural, organic way to introduce characters that could potentially age into roles much the way that Carl did. From the get-go. So I think there's a potential for that there, but I don't know that they're willing to fully commit to it as well, you know.
Right. Well, let's get into Negan. I mean, this was – both of us have never – or neither of us have ever read Negan in the comics. And if we did, we probably wouldn't enjoy it given our lack of enjoyment of Mr. Kirkman's dialogue. But
right.
We were told by some that we would enjoy the character of Negan. And damn if Jeffrey Dean Morgan didn't knock this out of the park and really bring a crazy villain to life, seemingly.
And played that black humor, that gallows humor to perfection, man. Like it's truly gonna be one of those villains in the vein. Not that the characters are similar, but it's going to be a villain in the vein of Hannibal Lecter in that you can't help but to love to hate him. Like, he's utterly detestable, and yet you're endlessly captivated
mm-hmm.
and entertained by him. And so,
I would even compare him to the Joker, to some of the interpretations
yes.
of the Joker. You know,
right.
he's making offhand jokes as he's murdering these people, and you know, in some cases, putting them through psychological torture, and at the same time, you hate him, but you're just endlessly fascinated by him, and you don't want him to leave the screen.
Right. And that's my concern, is that yeah. he's not going to be on screen for, you know, episodes at a time here.
Yeah, he was so good. And I never really had any doubt, because I know Jeffrey Dean Morgan's awesome. He's been good in everything I've seen him in,
right.
but man, this was just a new side to him that I haven't seen.
It's also the only time I've ever watched an episode of The Walking Dead and went, I can't wait to watch the uncensored version of this whenever they release it on Blu-ray. Because, and not for violence this time, which is typically what you get in those uncensored versions. That and, you know, some black and white imagery from the first season. But apparently they're going to do an uncensored cut of this season that has unedited dialogue from Negan, where apparently there are going to be, you know, F-bombs and GD this and GD that every other line. And I can't wait, personally.
And it also speaks to something. I think that this episode addressed a problem that I'm not sure that we realized The Walking Dead has had the last couple seasons, in that when The Walking Dead has been at its best, generally, outside of an isolated episode here and there, there has been a central villain.
Or at least a central antagonist in the vein of Shane.
Shane, yeah. In the first two seasons. And then the governor, of course. And
the governor picked up right after that.
Right after
much.
That. And so you went...
Since the governor, essentially, yeah. I mean, they went from... I mean, Terminus wrapped up once they finally got there in one episode, essentially.
Very quickly, yes. Terminus was almost nothing.
Then you had the cannibals. They were there for a tour, like what felt like a mini arc. So you had those guys for a little while. But pretty much since then, I mean, the entire road to Alexandria, the first little story arc in Alexandria, you didn't really have
a central antagonist. Yeah,
maybe you had
groups here and there. You had that group that Daryl got up with that... The claimers, and they didn't last very long.
No.
And then, of course, you know, you got the wolves, and that didn't last very long.
Right.
So, you know, yeah.
You had Jesse's abusive husband that didn't last very long.
No. And you just – it's easier to galvanize the audience when you've got a central antagonist to root against. And – we just haven't had that for a while now. The conflicts have been more internal group conflicts between Rick and Michonne, between Carol and the group, between, you know, Tyrese and the group, whatever it's been. Carol and Morgan. And now we've got an external threat that theoretically should unify the group again, and I think that's kind of what the show's been needing for a while. Like, it was okay to break away from that villain formula for a little while, but now we're past the point where it's time to get back and give us somebody that we can root against. And for my money, I mean, we're only one episode in, and I don't want to diminish how great the governor was, but so far, man, Negan is setting the bar pretty high for villains in the world.
Right. This is a completely different kind of villain. You know, it's, like you said, very much in the vein of the Joker. So, whereas the governor was more, more Penguin or Black Mask, this is more Joker. And this is, you know, obviously going to lend itself to very high levels of entertainment. So... I can't wait to see where they go from this, and I am already hoping that this is not a one season storyline. If they follow the comics, based on my limited understanding of the comics, you know, since I haven't read a ton, Negan should be a factor for at least one or at least two seasons going forward, if not more than that. So,
yeah, and I mean, again, I don't want to comment too much on the. On the comics, because I haven't read that far into him, but apparently Negan still hasn't really been dealt with in the comics fully, so in a satisfactory manner. So they've got plenty to mine out of it if they choose to. So we'll have to see where it goes. But I guess with all that being said, thumbs up from both of us.
Absolutely. So, you know, we should probably talk a little bit about, you know, the central plot of this episode, which was essentially Rick and Negan driving around in the RV, and the idea is that Negan is trying to teach Rick, I mean, for a lack of a better term, a lesson in humility, which is something that that Rick kind of needed. He needed to be knocked down a peg after the events of recent episodes, and so it's essentially Rick or Negan showing Rick that he's pretty much going to make Rick do whatever the hell he wants, and Rick is going to do it, and that's what he does over the course of this episode. He forces Rick to go out and, you know, get an axe from the middle of a zombie-infested field of some sort. He almost forces Rick to cut off Carl's hand. Just so many different little things where he's just screwing with Rick over the course of the entire episode, and I loved it, man. Loved it.
Yeah, and you know, and hey, I was shocked we didn't get a single Coral out of it. It was just whimpering, mainly.
Whimpering and snot rockets.
Yes. So, but great.
Owen Hart like snot rockets.
Fantastic acting from across the board from the crew. The pacing of this episode was really good. The tension, as we mentioned earlier, and it leaves you on a note where, you know, you've got Maggie and Sasha headed towards this mysterious group that we really don't know much about, and then you've got...
No, we've been to the Hilltop already in season 6.
Have we? I don't even remember that.
Yep. Remember, that's where Jesus was from.
Right, but I thought we hadn't been there because we haven't met the tiger guy or whatever.
No, that's the kingdom, not the Hilltop.
Oh, well, whatever. That's right.
The Hilltop had the lecherous leader who made weird, creepy advances
that's
towards
right.
Maggie.
Yeah, yeah. The Hilltop. I'm getting my oddly named communities wrong. So they're going to the Hilltop, and then you've got the rest of the gang heading back to Alexandria and trying to reunite with the people that are there, which you have seemingly a group divided on whether they should go back and gather their forces and fight, or whether they should just do what Negan says so that they don't get bashed in the head with barbed wire baseball bats.
Yeah, yeah. I'm pretty sure I know where it's going to go, at least for the short term. I mean, you at least from a storytelling standpoint, mm-hmm. you have to have them acquiesce at least for a little mm-hmm. while. You have to have them, you know, build the tension, build the heat, so to speak, before you go into the comeback segment.
We're just wrestling this podcast completely into the ground.
But are we wrestling it to the ground?
Well, we only can do that if it's a 60-minute Iron Man match.
Well, this was actually a 60-minute episode plus 6 minutes, so you might say it was the WrestleMania 12 of Walking Dead episodes.
I did think it was somewhat odd when Chris Hardwick walked in at the 60-minute mark and said there needed to be 6 more minutes. That was pretty unprecedented, I have to say. Quite frankly, some might suggest that it's okay to end The Walking Dead on a time limit draw, folks.
Mm.
But it's not for me to say. I'm not in charge of creative. I don't work there anymore, folks. Anyway,
yep.
So with all that being said, The Walking Dead, Episode 1 of Season 7, a rousing success, in my opinion, in your opinion as well. Do you disagree with us? Do you agree with us? Let us know. Come to Place to Be Nation, Comics Facebook page, tweet us. On our Twitter handles, at gphillips8652, at nickduke87. Let us know your thoughts on the premiere episode. Maybe you disagree with us. Maybe you agree with us. And a little exercise for you. Nick, you have to substitute in two characters from the cast that were present to trade in for Glenn and Abraham. I know who one of them would be. But what two characters would it be? And why?
They had to be present in the semicircle.
To be present in the semicircle. Yep.
So you understand that you can't pick Gabriel, right?
I am completely aware of that.
Okay, I'm just making sure you're aware.
And let me be clear: you don't have to substitute anyone. You could leave it as it is, or you can substitute someone in.
Carl, for all the reasons in the world. First.
Okay.
Here's one. It's somewhat controversial. Michonne.
Ooh,
would be my other one.
Really?
Because if you genuinely want to shock people, if you want to shake things up a bit from the comics, what bigger way to do that than Michonne? Especially since she is now in a relationship with Rick, and because that would essentially be taking away the group's most effective physical threat at that point. I think that would add a whole new dynamic to everything. I'll say Carl and Michonne, because then essentially you have taken away Rick Grimes' family right in front of his eyes.
Yes, that's true. That's a good one. I think I can shake things up even more. My two replacements would be Maggie, first of all. Not because of any problem with Maggie, but the deal with Maggie is she's pregnant, and I feel like inverting the comic book formula in this case would have been both nihilistic in the vein of the show and also would have been an interesting character change for Glenn. It would have been really compelling to see how this fundamentally changes Glenn moving forward.
Do you not think that would have caused an even greater level of uproar than what this caused?
Yes.
A pregnant woman being beaten to death in brutal fashion on television?
Yes, but I would argue they've already killed a pregnant woman on the show before. That remember, Lori died before they pulled the baby out, technically. So, they, at least that was my understanding of that scene. So the I think that it would have been in the vein of the show to the point where I was actually almost expecting it to happen because I thought, man, that's going to be such a cruel move, and it would be so cruel for the audience. It would be so difficult to watch. So that would have been one, and then my big one, Rick, because nothing would flip the show on its head like killing off the quote unquote main character who you and I have argued has really been part of an ensemble of main characters for several seasons now. This would also allow someone else to step up and take control of leadership of the group, be it Daryl, be it Glenn in this situation, be it Carol would make plenty of sense at this point.
No, Carol, but, Carol has to take her biannual leave of absence for some reason.
Right, so I would have thrown Rick to the wolves, so to speak, and turned things on its head. That being said, everything worked out great.
I feel like choosing Rick, though, is equally as unrealistic as choosing a character that wasn't even in the semicircle. Just saying.
Probably, but it would have been neat regardless. So, with all that being said, great episode. Excited to see where it goes from now, and I'm sure it will be added into our rotation of read and watching going forward. With all that being said, we're going to send it to a commercial break, and when we come back, we've got all of the normal stuff that you expect from us. We've got read and watching. We've got the rundown. We've got chitter chatter back and forth. And
what about chitty? What about chitty chitty bang bang?
And we've got a Dick Van Dyke or a Beep Van Beep impression. All of that coming your way right after this.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Voice of Ring of Honor's Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you're subscribed to all of our great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. Just head to iTunes today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be podcast feed, the PWO PTBN feed, PTBN Pop, and of course the Kevin Kelly Show feed, which includes the full archives of my podcast. Some really great stuff. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. Thanks for being a fan of professional wrestling. More importantly, thanks for being a fan and supporter of the Place to Be Nation.
Place to Be Nation is JT Rizzuto here. In addition to the archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. And we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be podcast feed, you can check out Scott Friscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with clotheslines and headlines, main event, Mission Indie Possible, in our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on WWE, NXT, and Ring of Honor Super Shows. Relive Wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse and the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast as we dive into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. All of this in addition to Scott Keith's Podcast of Doom, which includes discussions on questions from listeners as well as current day and old school wrestling. We also have sports covered too with the Sports Lounge, the TJ McClun Show, and NBA Team Podcast. On our brand new PTB Pop podcast feed, we offer great shows such as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both feeds on iTunes and be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows are available on PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to check out on the right-hand side of the site for details on how to support the site when you shop at Amazon and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is Parv, and I'm here to tell you to listen and subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only Place to Be Nation podcast network. That's the PWO PTBN podcast network, where you'll find a ton of in-depth shows done by hardcore fans. We've got Chris Zellner's 1-2 Punch of Exile on Bad Street, and with David Bickenspan, a smash hit Between the Sheets. We've got Wrestling Culture with Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave, Goodwill Wrestling and the Reaction Shows with Good Old Will from Texas. We've got This Week in Wrestling with my man Pete and Johnny Sorrow, Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston's Pro Wrestling Super Show, Tag Team's Back Again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze, and a ton of other great shows too. And of course, there's Titans of Wrestling and Where the Big Boys Play with yours truly and some dude from down south called Chad. PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network.
Read out and watch out. What you been reading and watching?
What you been reading and watching?
And we're back, ladies and gentlemen. Children of all ages, as mentioned at the beginning of the broadcast in my completely original introduction. We're back for the normal portion of our show that you would expect at the beginning. We flip-flopped it this time, again, in an effort to shake things up a bit here at the Hard Traveling Fanboys. Nick, I think that we should start the way we normally start, don't you?
That's fine with me. As you heard coming back from the break, with our glorious jingle that made its debut last week, you just heard those dulcet tones. So let's jump right into what we've been reading and watching.
And in this case, of course, we always do our top three, bottom one book of the time period. I say the time period. It's a week, but I am still in a multi-week catch-up process. I still haven't completely caught up yet due to financial reasons and also time reasons. However, I think this week we should start with our bottom one. Nick, are you comfortable with that?
I'm fine with it. You go right ahead.
I'll go right ahead. Now, this was, as is often the case with me, I tend to enjoy comics. I tend to enjoy particularly the comics that I'm pulling on a weekly and monthly basis. So it's hard for me to pick a bottom book a lot of times because I don't want to bury any of these books that are in my list. In this case, it's a batch of really good books that I read, entertaining books that I truly enjoyed from beginning to end. If I had to pick a bottom book of this time period, I have no choice but to go. And again, please don't hate me, Jenny, because I actually did like this book. I have to go with Green Lantern's number 6. This was the wrap-up to the Red Lantern's story arc, mm-hmm. Red Dawn. Mm-hmm. And more on this book a little bit later, perhaps. But it was a good story. It was a good comic. I had no issues with it, really. The reason it gets at the bottom of my list is, compared to the other ones, I thought that this story was wrapped up a little conveniently for my taste.
To say the least.
To say the least. Did not care for the final battle. It had kind of been building for a long time, and nothing really happens. Atrocitus just leaves. And that was not satisfying in any way. And I wasn't a huge fan of pretty much a lack of action in the book. I'm okay with slow down issues. You know, that's my thing, even with Green Lantern. But when you're doing a culmination issue of a Green Lantern story arc, I'm expecting Hal and Sinestro having a fist fight on the moon, or Necron facing down the forces of the combined Lantern Corps, or you know, or even on a smaller scale, something like Sinestro and Mongol having a knockdown drag out between each other. In this, we basically get a giant flower thing that destroys the Hell Tower. So, you know, again, not a bad comic by any means. I still enjoyed it. The interaction between Simon Baz and Jessica Cruz is tremendous and carries the entire thing. The art was good by Will Conrad. But, you know, just didn't knock my socks off.
All right. Well, moving on to my bottom book of the week. Much like you, Greg, I mean, I enjoyed, for the most part, all the books I read this week. But if I got to pick a bottom book, I am going with Superman number 9. This is the second part, the finale of the Escape from Dinosaur Island storyline that I mentioned I wasn't very high on 2 weeks ago. A fine book, nothing overly wrong with it. I just don't find the losers who they mention here to be overly compelling, an old World War II version of the losers, essentially. And, you know, the Dinosaur Island thing, which I know is tied into the work of Darwin Cook. I get all that. I understand why the story exists. I vastly preferred the you know, 6-7 issues that preceded this storyline. And I am very much looking forward to the follow-up storyline, which is finally going to be the first meeting of John Kent and Damian Wayne, apparently. That's going to set up Super Son. So, you know, nothing wrong with this book. It just didn't grab me the way that the Superman title has been since Rebirth started. So I'm going Superman number 9 as my bottom book of the week.
All right, and that moves us into our top 3 of the time period. And at my number 3 selection here, my number 3 spot, if you will, and I will, I have got Blue Beetle Rebirth. This came out quite a while ago, I believe back in August, if I'm not mistaken. It somehow got missed on my pull, and I finally got a copy of it, my hands on a copy of it, thanks to loyal listener and jingle writer David Sunday. And
we just gave away his real name, Greg, for God's sake.
What I mean is a loyal listener whose name I may have lied about just now. Right. This book, Blue Beetle Rebirth by Keith Giffen and Scott Collins, this is a really refreshing teen book, I have to say. This caught me off guard a little bit with how well written, which I had heard from some people. The dialogue was really well written between the characters, which is a problem in a lot of teen-based books. That's teen, T-E-E-N, as opposed to T-E-A-M, team books. And they often struggle with trying to sound contemporary, trying to sound hip. This just came off like a bunch of likable characters, a bunch of believable, likable characters that everybody knows. Everybody has friends like Jaime's friends in this book who are constantly chirping at each other, constantly getting into conflicts with each other, etc., and trying to play peacemaker between them. And then you've got Ted Kord, who essentially is Ray Palmer from Legends of Tomorrow. And it's just a really good, fun book. And there's a good spot for this, a good place for this in the Rebirth Initiative. And I am in for now. I've heard that the first issue is not quite as good as the Rebirth, but I'm going to stick with this because it's a monthly title. And it's a book that is kind of unlike anything else I'm reading right now. So, thumbs up to Blue Beetle Rebirth.
Yeah, I also enjoyed the Rebirth issue. I did not enjoy the number 1 as much. And, you know, with the standards being so high to make the pull list, this one's actually off of mine right now. But I hope you enjoy it, and I hope it gets better after that number 1. So anyway, my number 3 book of the week, I'm going Green Lanterns number 9. I don't want to say too much here because you haven't had a chance to read this book yet, but I will say, this is what I will say. It is not often that you are able to create a new villain that is almost instantly compelling, understandable, and relatable. And here, Sam Humphries creates what I think is going to be a fantastic addition to the Green Lantern rogues gallery, to the Green Lantern mythos. I completely understand the motivations of this villain. It makes sense. It makes you wonder why no one had ever approached this concept before. I am very excited about this Phantom Lantern storyline. Phantom Lantern storyline now. And it does a great job of pairing this new villain up with a classic Green Lantern villain that was used by Geoff Johns towards the end of his run. So, you know, very cool concepts going on here. And this this issue is entirely focused on said new villain. So big push out of the gate for this guy. And it's mostly focused on the way he feels and the way he thinks rather than what a physical threat he is at this point. So helping you to understand this guy first before we see him in battle, I think, is a big step in the right direction. And I cannot wait to see what they have in store for this guy.
Excellent. Very much looking forward to it. My number two book of the time period is Wonder Woman number 6 by Greg Rucka and Nicola Scott. This is a book that continued the Wonder Woman Year One storyline that they've been telling, and also introduces us to a younger version of Barbara Minerva, who will later become the Cheetah. And this just continues to wow me. I know that you have mentioned that you're more into the other storyline, the Lies. I think I'm actually more into Year One right now. I like them both. They're both great. But I think this is scratching my itch for a – maybe it's because I haven't read much Wonder Woman in my life. But I'm really digging this updated origin for her and this the cast of characters – that she's interacting with, and it's a little thing, but I love that Rucka doesn't – I don't have anything against the writers that ignore the language barrier in comics, because it's a difficult issue to deal with. But I love how Rucka handles it here, because nobody can understand Diana, and Diana can't understand anybody because she's speaking an outdated language that no one else has ever really heard until Barbara Minerva is able to sort of decipher what she's saying a little bit. And when she does decipher it, it doesn't make any sense because Diana's talking about gods and man horses and deer, you know, all these classic ancient Greek concepts that sound crazy when you talk about them in real life. But just a wonderful issue with terrific art. Nicola Scott draws Diana as well as damn near anybody, and it's just just continues to be one of the standout books of the DC Rebirth Initiative.
Absolutely. Moving on to my number two book of the week, I'm going with Batman number 9. This is the first part of the I Am Suicide storyline, and the gimmick here is that Batman is working with Amanda Waller to essentially create his own version of the Suicide Squad for a mission to Santa Prisca to face off with Bane. And this issue is entirely about Batman walking through Arkham Asylum and putting his team together. And you had me at the ventriloquist, first of all. You had me at Arnold Wesker, who he brings on as the team's chief strategist and, you know, a very fitting role. Now, it's got some characters in here I'm not overly familiar with. Characters like Julie and Punch. Don't know anything about them. Don't know where they came from, but I'm intrigued by them. But it's also got a closing scene with a certain female character that I know, Greg, you're very much looking forward to and that, you know, is trying to give you false hope. I will say that much. But overall, man, it was just as he's walking through Arkham, you get, you know, a good look at all these different Batman villains. Mikael Janin draws them excellently. I really, really enjoyed this issue, and it's got me excited for this I Am Suicide story. I can't wait for this one. You know, when the Gotham and Gotham Girl storyline first started, I think we both were kind of hesitant, and it wound up impressing me more than it did you. But this is the first storyline on this book that I'm actively excited for. So very, very intrigued to see where this goes. And I almost forgot to mention, the book actually opens with a pretty awesome Bane flashback scene where you kind of see what it's like to be Bane and what it's like to live through some of those experiences that he's had in his life. So I think you're going to enjoy this one when you finally get around to it.
Of course!
That's the one thing. That's a great version of Bane, but I still don't read the comics version in that voice.
Yeah, that's a good point. Although I had heard that they were going to be bringing the comics version closer to that version, apparently.
I mean, he's still very heavily bathed in the trappings of Latin America, Santa Prisca, and that kind of thing. So it's kind of hard to jive right. That more Eastern European vibe that you get from Tom Hardy's Bane with that.
Right, right. And as a bit of a news item here, I have decided, as I mentioned, that I am going to be adding Batman back to my pull list. I haven't done that yet, but I am going to be buying this issue off the shelf. Generally, here's a shocking news alert, folks. Comic book shops generally don't have a problem having enough copies of Batman. So I think I'm just going to buy this one off the shelf for a little while and see if it can hook me. And if it does, then I'll have to clear something else off my pull list, and I'll update the good folks here on the podcast about that when the time comes. Moving on to my number one book of the week. This one was a pretty easy selection for me because I enjoyed this one so much. Green Lanterns number 7 by Sam Humphries and a substitute artist, actually, who I am going to look up his name right now because I don't recall him ever drawing an issue of this before. Cliquette appears to be his last name. I don't know the pronunciation of it, clearly. Ronan Cliquette, which is an awesome name. Anyway, he's the fill-in artist. But this is an issue that has zero action. No action. There isn't to be found here. There's not a fight to be had. Most of the issue, they're not doing Green Lantern stuff. It's Jessica Cruz trying to hang out with Simon Baz at his family's Halloween get-together. And for Jessica, who is filled with anxiety and literally lived alone in an apartment for 2 years and didn't leave the apartment, this is all a bit much. And seeing how she is trying to deal with being in this social setting while Simon is trying to deal with the expectations of his family, in particular his mother, who he's had a rocky relationship with, this is just an amazing issue. I mean, seeing the two of them bonding over things that are huge holes in their personalities. For Simon, it's the things that he's done in the past and the way that he's isolated his family in the past. For Jessica, it's her anxiety and her inability to overcome to overcome her fears, to overcome her hang-ups that have affected her entire life. But when they're together, they help each other overcome the differences. To use the line from Rocky, they fill in the gaps. And it's, again, just a tremendous, tremendous issue from beginning to end. There's a lot of great little character moments here, a glimpse of Simon Baz's childhood and the trouble that he got into and why he got into that trouble. And you see Simon's mother and why she's the way that she is. And you see Jessica kind of almost becoming a part of the family. And it's just, again, another step up for Sam Humphries after the Red Dawn arc was up and down, but I think the book is really finding its footing. If what you said about issue 9 is true, then it feels like the book is really finding its footing now by centering on what it's best at, which is this cop team of Simon Baz and Jessica Cruz. They're just killing it right now, and now they're getting their own villain that's not an established villain to go against, and that's going to be really cool.
Absolutely. Can't wait for you to catch up on that one. Finally, finishing off with my number one book of the week, and I'm going with a Marvel book. I'm going with The Mighty Thor number 12. This is a book that is dealing largely with a new ability that we saw Mjolnir have in the previous issue number 11, where it's revealed that Mjolnir probably has a little bit more sentience than we had originally been led to believe. And that's all fine, well, and good, but the reason I love this book so much is that we were able to revisit some locales and some concepts from Jason Aaron's earliest Thor run, God Bomb and the God Butcher storyline. We get to go back to Omnipotent City. We get to go back and revisit with the High Librarian of all the realms and all the gods and those kind of things.
Does he know the High Evolutionary by any chance?
You know, I don't actually know that the High Librarian is the technical term for it, but I would assume, yes, he knows the High Evolutionary. Now, does he know the Low Evolutionary or the Middle Evolutionary? Those are the keys.
I feel like we'd need a Marvel expert to tell us, but
we would. But in any event, this is Jason Aaron getting to deal with these concepts that he created and add some new layers to the Thor mythos. And, you know, I've come to the realization, as we discussed offline, that I think Jason Aaron is at his best when he's writing Thor, when he is adding new spokes to the wheel, so to speak. Not that he doesn't deal with pre-established elements very well. I think his Malekith is exceptionally well written. I've loved his take on the Minotaur. But when he's adding things like Gore the God Butcher or Omnipotent City or dealing with the librarian character, and here telling a flashback of almost like Mjolnir's secret origin, it's all so much more vibrant than when he's dealing with pre-existing concepts. This is a guy who seems tailor-made to create rather than treading in the footsteps of those who came before him. So I really love this book. I think it's the best issue of the Mighty Thor thus far, and I highly recommend it to anyone. It can even work as a standalone issue for anyone who has read God Butcher and God Bomb and is looking for more stories featuring some of those themes and locales.
Very good, Mr. Lau. Now we move on to our quick hits. I'm assuming you have some quick hits as well.
I do.
We'll trade back and forth on this one, bouncing really quick thoughts. I'll start off with Green Arrow number 6, Sins of the Mother Part 1. Pretty good book, I thought. I enjoyed this version of the Clock King. I also enjoyed the focus on Amiko Queen, one of the better new characters in the DC Universe.
Awesome. Green Arrow number 9. I think this was probably the weakest issue of Green Arrow thus far. The Island of Scars storyline is already wrapping up, but I thought the first part was much, much better than the second part.
Green Arrow number 7. I think this is the weakest issue of the book that I've read thus far. Sins of the Mother Part 2, again, wraps up far too quickly and far too conveniently for my tastes. Nothing of note really interesting happened. The fight against the Dragon Man was not well illustrated by, I believe this artist is Stephen Byrne. It was very confusing. It was hard to tell what was going on. Honestly, the leader of the Yakuza turning into a dragon is not an idea that appeals to me as a fan of Yakuza stories, so wasn't a big fan of this one.
Aquaman number 9. By default, I think the weakest issue of Aquaman thus far, but that's only because the series has been so amazing over the first 8 issues. Number 9 is still a really good issue, but I will say that the Shaggy Man isn't quite as compelling as some of the other threats that Aquaman has faced thus far in this run.
Titans number 3, Kadabra's Revenge. Another good issue in this. I really enjoy this. This probably would have made my top 3 were it not for my continuing issues with the Brett Booth art. I'm just not a huge fan of his. I'm not going to criticize him too much because I couldn't do what he does. But I'm just not a fan of the way that he draws faces. But the writing was spectacular here. All of the particularly the scenes between Wally and Linda. At the very end, they have an awesome conversation that is right out of the classic Flash repertoire.
Absolutely. And finally, for me on my quick hits, Trinity number 2. This book just missed my top 3. The art, again, is outstanding from Francis Manapul. The writing is outstanding. I don't know why this book has gotten the mixed reviews it has, but if you enjoy a book that largely focuses on the character-based interactions between Superman, Wonder Woman, and Batman, this is the book for you. Don't listen to the haters. Trinity number 2. Check it out.
Teen Titans Rebirth by Ben Percy and John Boy and Billy Myers. That's actually not his name. His name is John Boy Myers. Really solid introduction to the Teen Titans. Not spectacular, not amazing, not blow away, but as an issue that introduces you to the team, a very good start. If you've never read a Teen Titans book before, pick this up. It introduces you to all the characters, lets you know what their personalities are, things of that nature. And there you have it. That wraps up the reading portion of reading and watching. And now we move on to the, what we might as well just call this week again, the CW section of the show, where we talk about what we've been watching, which is predominantly CW shows. And I guess we'll start off with the last Monday's airing of Supergirl. Which
now, did you get to watch the most recent Supergirl before we get started?
No.
We're going to perpetually be off out of sync on this Supergirl, I believe.
That's correct. And so episode 2 of Supergirl, which aired last Monday on the CW, this was a, I thought, even better episode than the premiere, personally. I thought this was a step up from the premiere. This featured Metallo in his fully realized form.
Metallos,
that's right, two Metallos. And also featured the last appearance, for the time being anyway, of Superman, which to me was better than it was in the premiere. The usage of him, not the usage of him, but the acting got a little bit better in the second episode. I think he maybe started to settle into the role a little bit. And the writing continued to be outstanding for both Supergirls.
And practically no James Olsen.
Practically no James Olsen, which is always a good thing. A surprisingly touching subplot with Cat Grant. A great subplot with Superman and the Martian Manhunter. And again, Supergirl continuing to be one of the best characters, along with Barry Allen, the two most likable lead characters on television. And I say that without much hesitation. They're great. And she,
I feel like you're not including Dr. Eugene Porter in that discussion, but that's neither.
Well,
there.
I would say he's not a lead character.
Well, that's your opinion.
I guess it depends on how you watch the show. And again, I love Oliver Queen, but I wouldn't classify him as a really likable guy. You know, he's a little rough around the edges. But Supergirl is just a beacon of light, and Melissa Benoist plays her with such precision. I thought it was another stellar episode.
I did as well. I don't know that I would say it was better than the premiere. I loved the premiere as well. Supergirl, now that it's on the CW, these first two episodes, I think, are as good, if not better, than anything they did in Season 1. I was a big fan of Season 1. So Supergirl has come out of the gates firing on all cylinders, in my opinion. I can't give overly detailed thoughts because it's a little bit fresher in your mind than it is in mine, because I watched it as it aired and I haven't seen it since, and I've got another episode that's overriding those thoughts already, so we got to figure out a way to get our Supergirl thoughts lined up at some point in the future, but the future is not today.
Right. I blame Monday Night Raw, personally, as I do for many things in my life. But
You'll find that watching Supergirl gives you a good excuse to fast forward through some of the, you know, things you aren't interested in on Monday Night Raw.
I'm R-Truth. They call me R-Trizzle. He's Gold Dust, and they call him Gold Dizzle.
That's right. Thanks to Supergirl, Greg, I haven't seen a Golden Truth segment in weeks. Try it. Supergirl, the antidote to Golden Truth.
In any event, that brings us to Tuesday and what I thought was the episode of the week, The Flash. This was the second episode of the season. Again, I thought this was better than the season premiere. For me, actually, by a pretty good margin, it was better than the season premiere. I really, really liked this episode. This was the return of – and this was better than episode 2 as well, by the way. This was the return of Harrison Wells and his daughter, who now has powers, Jesse Quick. And he brings – so much to this show, and she does as well. She's great, but Wells in particular is a character that brings so much to this show. Having Tom Cavanaugh back in the Flash cast was just a godsend. The whole show was elevated. There were so many great scenes here. Barry and Iris go on their first date, and it goes exactly how Barry and Iris's first date should go, which is incredibly badly and awkwardly. And she's okay with it being awkward and bad, and that is the Barry and Iris dynamic in a nutshell. She is okay with him being a giant dork. And so many great moments. My favorite line in the episode, my favorite scene in the episode being Joe and Barry having their heart-to-heart, and he's trying to explain to Barry what dad cop is, where you got good cop, bad cop, and dad cop, where you're stern but loving. And then Barry's like, well, I don't remember you ever doing that to me. And then Joe's like, well, it's different with you. You're like a second daughter to me. You talk about your emotions too much. Legitimate laugh out loud moment, of which there were a few in this episode. So I can't say enough about this. This was easily my favorite episode of the season so far of The Flash.
I think I still enjoyed the Flashpoint season premiere a little bit better, but I would agree I also very much enjoyed this episode. Always good to see Harrison Wells back. Good to see he's going to be sticking around at least for a few more episodes. He just adds a certain something to the show that is missing whenever he's not there. I feel like you need somebody in that older mentor role, and I feel like now they're in a position where they can pretty much interchangeably use either Jay Garrick or Harrison Wells, depending on what the story calls for. And yep. I'm glad that both of those characters have already made appearances this season, and I hope they continue to tag those out as needed, and hopefully potentially down the road get a you know, maybe a storyline where they're both involved. Because to my knowledge, I don't think this version of Harrison Wells and the one true Jay Garrick have had a whole lot of interaction on the show thus far.
Not a whole lot. And
I think it'd be an interesting dynamic.
Yeah, for sure. And what do you make of the continuing Dr. Alchemy storyline?
I think it's British douchey coworker Draco Malfoy guy.
I would tend to agree, but I think they're almost making it too obvious.
Yes, because when he had that almost like cheesy mustache twirling moment where he looks at Bear and he goes, "Dr. Alchemy, ever heard that name before?" And it just felt really on the nose. So maybe it's a little bit of misdirection.
I particularly like your version of it where it sounds like Dr. Kevin Nash.
You know, any doctor that isn't Eugene Porter should always seek to emulate Dr. Kevin Nash.
That's correct. Well, speaking of Dr. Kevin Nash, speaking of pro wrestling references, which we have been accused of making in the past, we actually have a reason to do so for once. And that's because...
And apparently so did the writers of Arrow, given the aptly named title of name of the new street drug in Star City.
That's right, because for once, our two interests... intersected, and it's once again thanks to Stephen Amell, who last summer wrestled in the WWE's SummerSlam pay-per-view event, and as a way of paying it forward, or paying it back, I suppose you would say, helped his good buddy, Cody Rhodes, who portrayed the character of Stardust, get his first television acting gig, guest starring on Arrow as a new villain who is moving a street drug, and the name of the street drug...
You guessed it, Frank Stallone.
What a weird name for a drug, Frank Stallone. These kids are all hooked on Frank Stallone, they are. No, Stardust is the name of the drug, and I think both Nick and I had a vested interest in how this episode would go. You know, not that we're not exactly running around wearing Cody Rhodes shirts or anything, but we like the guy. And
yeah, I mean, it's always cool to see a guy branch out a little bit and, you know, take a leap of faith by leaving WWE as he has recently and try new things. And it seems like he's doing well in his future endeavors, as it were. So, yeah, it was good to see him give a pretty good, you know, a pretty good turn here. And I thought the writers did a good job of working around his lack of experience. He didn't have a ton of dialogue to deliver. He was mostly used as a physical threat, and that's something he can do. Fight choreography is clearly something he has, you know, a little bit of knowledge of. Granted, you know, pro wrestling is a little bit different than television fight choreography, but, you know, I think his pro wrestling background served him well in some of the stunt scenes here.
Absolutely, and the episode as a whole also continued what we've seen in the early part of this season, where Oliver is trying to do some field training with this new team that he's kind of reluctantly assembled, and also, again, playing with the duality as he continues to struggle to successfully manage both sides of his life, his costume persona as the Green Arrow and his secret identity as the mayor, Oliver Queen. And this continues that thread. What did you make of this episode, Nick? How did you feel about it when it was over?
Yeah, I enjoyed it for the most part. I especially liked the introduction of the new character, Adrian Chase, the new district attorney, who we already know will become the character known as Vigilante. But I liked it mainly because, and this is a statement that a lot of people disagree with, because a lot of people hold this as a criticism of the show, but I hold it as, you know, hold it as praise. I feel like Arrow is at its best when it is essentially a Batman show. They have used Oliver Queen on the CW in this universe as a stand-in for Bruce Wayne for the most part.
Yep.
And his interactions, limited as they were and as preliminary as they were with Adrian Chase in this episode, felt like their version of introducing the Bruce Wayne-Harvey Dent dynamic, which anybody who knows me knows I'm a sucker for that dynamic. So if they're going to be taking cues from that, I personally am very excited to see where this goes. So I love that. That being said, I did have a couple. One little issue was, so Wild Dog in this episode, who we talked about before and how neither of us are overly high on him, he takes some actions that, you know, wind up messing up some plans the DA has for bringing down the entire drug running operation. And Oliver, you know, deservedly so, verbally lights into him for making that mistake. The problem is, later in the episode, he comes back and apologizes for seemingly no reason at all and didn't really have anything to apologize for. In my opinion, Wild Dog was 100% in the wrong. But I will give the writers credit for this. After Oliver tears into Wild Dog, he walks away and Felicity walks up to Wild Dog, and I was preliminarily rolling my eyes at the, oh God, here comes the den mother Felicity thing where she consoles Wild Dog. And nope, instead, they actually had Felicity agree with Oliver on something, which was, I'm not even exaggerating, legitimately shocking to me after the first couple episodes of the season. So good to see that Felicity isn't just patently disagreeing with anything and everything Oliver does anymore.
Additionally, Anatoly continues to be a compelling character.
Yeah, the flashbacks are great. I mean, the flashbacks, I would argue, are the single biggest point of improvement from last season to this. Mainly because last season's flashbacks were among the worst things the DCCW universe has ever done.
And
this season's are among some of the best flashbacks Arrow's ever done. So this is a massive, massive step forward.
And it for the first time in a few seasons, even I would say probably even using season 3 as an example, which we both loved the flashbacks in that season for the most part, but
season 3 was the Hong Kong storyline, right?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Even in those flashbacks, while they were good, while it was a good story and it was really well acted by everybody involved, it didn't necessarily feel like pre-return from Island Oliver.
And it didn't necessarily feel overly linked. I mean, the flashbacks have always been at their best when they're directly tied to themes or concepts or ideas that are going on in the present day. And season 3, until they get to the end with the virus and how it ties into to Raish's plan or whatever, those felt largely disconnected. These feel perfectly in step with the story they're telling, so that you have the flashbacks, you have the present day sequence, but really they combine together to tell one thematic story. So yeah, these have been a big improvement.
Yeah. So yeah, another successful episode here in this fifth season of Arrow.
Season 5, yeah.
And they seem to be moving in a good direction. No Prometheus in this episode. Were you surprised by that?
No, I mean, if they're really going to, you know, stretch him out over the course of the entire season, which it looks like they are, you know, I told you, I thought one of the mistakes they made last season was they had never really attempted to have a villain heavily involved pretty much from the jump like they did with Damian Dark. And I think it's clear at a certain point they were spinning their wheels. And so if they're going to have Prometheus stretched out over the entire season, I think you need to have episodes, especially here in the early portion of the season, where you kind of put that on pause for a little bit and eventually come back to it. Because I think the showrunners have shown they kind of have an ideal zone when it comes to the length of time they can stretch out one villain. And I don't think having him heavily involved for an entire season is in their best interests.
Agreed for sure. So thumbs up to Arrow, another good episode there, and looking forward to where they go from here. Now, that leads us to Thursday and the last show in the DCCW lineup, which is Legends of Tomorrow. Now, this was an episode that takes place, again, in 1942, and so you have the Justice Society of America, which was the big selling point for this episode. You finally get to see the JSA in action, this version of the JSA, and you get to see their interaction with the Legends team, Ray Palmer, Sarah Lance, etc. And all that stuff was great. It was so cool to see the JSA in action. The only black mark on this episode would be the just abysmal CGI for the Captain Nazi character.
Krieger or Krieger, I believe, was his name.
Yes. Just some of the worst CGI you'll ever see.
It was very bad. For those of you out there who have seen for whatever reason, the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen movie. He looked not unlike the Mr. Hyde CGI from that movie that came out more than 10 years ago. He looked not unlike a beefed up version of the weird zombie creature things from Ion Legend, or not unlike one of the Venom-infused thugs from Batman Arkham Asylum, which was a game for the Xbox 360 that came out almost 10 years ago as well. So,
and not unlike the scene in the Ang Lee Hulk movie where the Hulk fights the dogs, which is a notoriously horrific CGI scene, and came out in 2002.
Indeed. I agree the CGI was a huge black mark, this was actually still, you know, even with the CGI included, my episode of the week, just because I loved everything about the Legends and the Justice Society interacting. We had been teased with images of the Justice Society pretty much, you know, all off-season whenever they were filming this. And, you know, it delivered in such a huge way. I thought they got pretty much every character right, with the exception of forgive my terminology, but the African-American member of the Justice Society was that Dr. Midnight? Or
yes, I believe that was Dr. Midnight.
Yeah, they didn't really give him much to do, but other than that, every other member of the JSA, Vixen, Obsidian's power set was
so well done.
Yeah,
I was going to say, how cool was that?
Yeah, Obsidian was awesome. Hourman was great. Commander Steel was great. Just the whole, Stargirl, I mean, Every character got their moment. The interactions were pitch perfect. I loved this episode. And I loved how they brought that 1940s, that golden age charm to the JSA without it seeming like a parody, you know, without it seeming almost like, if you remember that Legends episode of
Justice League,
where at a certain point you got the idea they were kind of poking fun at the Golden Age a little bit. This did not feel that way, but yet it retained some of that that earnest charm that you need when you're doing a 1940s version of the JSA.
And also, really happy they made Sarah the leader of the team. I feel like that was where they were going to go, and I'm really glad to see it act. Sometimes it's okay to do the expected thing. And I think of all the characters on the team, she fits the mold of the leader now that Rip's gone. And I'm really excited about that. And also, I was going to run this by you. I don't know if it was just me. I mentioned this to our friend Russell Sellers of Sellers Point Podcast over the weekend. It feels to me like Sarah on Legends of Tomorrow is being written like the Black Canary should be written.
Yeah. I think at some point, you know, from a storytelling standpoint, you know, Sarah Lance as a character won't hide in the time stream forever, and let's just leave it at that, you know, not to fantasy book too much.
Because the Black Canary is a character that has been on super teams in the past, a prominent member of the Justice League, and Sarah,
an even more prominent member of the Justice Society.
And yeah, the original version. Sarah has On Legends has assumed that role of the non-powered, non-gimmicky character that has to still assert herself as the leader of the group, and they're doing a great job with it.
Absolutely.
Well, that wraps up watching. Are there any other comic book shows or movies you've watched this past week?
No, I really haven't had an opportunity. Been very busy around here, so I haven't had a chance to get back on the Daredevil, Daredevil season 2, which means, of course, I haven't started Luke Cage. So, you know, at some point in the near future, hopefully, we'll have more to talk about there. But for the moment, no. And I'm still endlessly behind on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and not watching Gotham because
hashtag Gotham sucks.
So, no, nothing else here.
There is one thing though, Nick. We haven't talked about playing. I understand you finished episode 2 of the Batman Telltale game. Is that correct?
That is correct. Did you get to finish it?
I haven't even started it yet. I just got it downloaded the other night. So
right.
Thanks
yes,
to the
I,
delay
I,
on PlayStation 3.
I did finish it. So I'll keep. And since you haven't played it yet, I'll keep my thoughts very brief. I like this better than episode 1.
Wow, high praise.
you get a new mysterious villain. You are pretty much outright told that Penguin is not going to be the quote unquote big bad of this season. You also get more interactions with Selina Kyle. You get fascinating interactions with Harvey Dent and Carmine Falcone. I really, really loved this episode, and it has one of the most legitimately difficult, decisions in the history of Telltale games for me. The closing decision of this, you have to choose between saving two different characters in the Batman mythos. You must act. You can only save one. And it is... I agonized over it. Like, I pulled a Greg Phillips and paused the game so I could decide who I wanted to choose. And my choice, honestly, surprised even me when I made it. So, I think I know which way you'll go. But I think when you get there, you'll see why it was such a difficult decision for me to make.
Very good. I'm looking forward to it. I'm going to get started hopefully pretty soon here in the near future.
Yeah, episode 3 just came out today, so I got to download that and hopefully get to play that. I don't know that I'll finish by next week's episode, but
it hasn't come out. I'm fairly certain it hasn't come out for PS3 yet.
No, even the launch, even they put out a trailer for it. That dropped yesterday, and then the download was today, and the trailer said available tomorrow on PS4, Xbox One, Steam, and Mac and PC, or something else, and then like down at the bottom it says and coming soon for PS3, Xbox 360, and all these other platforms. So no, not available yet for you.
Woe is me. But in any ways, that wraps up what you're reading and watching, and that can only mean that it's time for the rundown, our weekly look at the news and notes throughout the comics landscape that appeal to us, that seem big stories to us. And unfortunately, we have to get started with the biggest story of the week, and it's a sad one. It's a bummer of a story because as anybody that has listened to us for a while knows, the comic book Preacher means a lot to Nick and I. One of our favorite books of all time in comics. And unfortunately, one of the co-creators of that book, legendary comic book artist Steve Dillon, passed away unexpectedly this past weekend at the age of 54, which is way too young.
Not to jump in too much, but was it really that unexpected? Because I remember reading, I don't know if it was, I want to say it was Liam Sharp who wrote something online, a tribute, and he mentions talking to Steve apparently last year, and Steve admitting that he, quote, wasn't long for this world or something like that. So makes me wonder if perhaps there was some sort of issue that we haven't, that wasn't made public for whatever reason.
I don't know. I mean, I haven't seen a cause of death or anything like that, but it was unexpected to me. I would say it was unexpected because I don't think
unexpected to
us.
Yes, that's true. That's true. Yes. From a fan perspective.
So Steve Dillon, who is the co-creator of Preacher, drew Preacher, drew Hellblazer.
Arguably the preeminent modern John Constantine and modern Punisher artist.
Yes, and I believe, you know, he just known for his longtime collaboration with his great friend Garth Ennis, the writer. Mm-hmm. But also known for his work with Jason Aaron on The Punisher, for his work throughout the comics medium with a variety of writers. Dillon is one of those distinctive artists that if you see an image that was drawn by him, you know it was drawn by him, if that makes sense. He had such a distinctive style that there is no doubt if you were reading a Steve Dillon comic. He's been responsible for so many comics that meant so much to so many people, especially of our generation.
Right.
Kids that grew reading comics in the 90s, the 2000s.
Right.
In our case, reading a lot of them in trade paperback or graphic novel form. Just a devastating loss for the industry in a year where we've already lost the great Darwin Cook. We've already lost just in entertainment. We've lost so many big names, and this is just another one to add to the list.
Absolutely. But all that being said, you know, obviously a true tragedy, but an outstanding career, an outstanding body of work that he put together. And in honor of that, Greg and I have actually made a decision to change up our plans a little bit. We had mentioned that our next Long Book Hunters was originally going to be a reach for some low-hanging fruit with a review of the Long Bow Hunters. But in honor of Steve Dillon, we are changing that. And November's Long Book Hunters will be a look at the Welcome Home Frank Castle storyline of the Punisher that is so heavily acclaimed. So looking forward to doing that in a couple of weeks as a little our little mini tribute to life and work of Steve Dillon.
Yeah, neither of us have ever read that story before, and what better time than now to finally dig into it.
Absolutely.
So really looking forward to that. So switching gears from that bummer of a note, we're going to go on to another somewhat disappointing note, not even in the same stratosphere as that, obviously, but the movie Deadpool was super successful and is obviously getting a sequel this year, Deadpool 2. Not this year, but is getting a sequel, Deadpool 2. But shockingly this week, it came out that the director, Tim Miller, has had a creative dispute with Ryan Reynolds, the star, and has left the project completely. Mm-hmm. He is off of Deadpool 2 and is being moved on to another Fox property, which will allow him kind of a little bit more creative freedom. He is doing a trilogy of sci-fi films based on a novel called Influx that I've never read, but it leaves Deadpool 2 without a director. So, and I think they're still working on a script for it, and this is really surprising news. I don't think that it's quite I think if you were going to lose one or the other, clearly you're going to lose the director instead of losing Ryan Reynolds, who was so instrumental in getting the movie made in the first place. But it is kind of a bummer given what a good job Tim Miller did with what was such a, considered to be such a risky movie.
Absolutely. You know, he was one of the people that helped the movie get made. You know, he worked on that that test footage that wound up, you know, being leaked, as I put up my Dr. Evil air quotes, that really generated the online momentum necessary for that movie to get greenlit. I will say, based on what I've read, the differences between he and Ryan Reynolds were pretty drastic. There are reports out there that would have you believe that they clashed over cable casting, first of all, that Miller was dead set on casting Friday Night Lights television star Kyle Chandler in the role. I don't know much about Mr. Chandler, but apparently Ryan Reynolds was fairly against that casting due to age, apparently. He didn't have that aged cable look. But then I think just today, actually, a little bit more details started to leak out in the way of – now, granted, these are all rumors, so this will, of course, be Russell Sellers' favorite moment of the rundown where we discuss baseless speculation and rumors. But rumor would have you believe that apparently the major difference here was that Ryan Reynolds, along with writers Rhett Reese and Paul Wernick, were very keen on making a movie that felt much like the first one in terms of, you know, a smaller scale, more personal movie, a smaller budget that was more focused on comedy and attitude, whereas Miller apparently wanted to do something more heavily stylized and something that would have a little bit bigger budget, something that would expand the scope a little bit and feel more like a big budget superhero movie. And so the rumors would have you believe that these two sides were pretty divided over what the future of the Deadpool franchise should be. And as a result, as you said, Greg, I mean, at this point, Ryan Reynolds is so intrinsically tied to the public perception of this character that if you're going to choose one, I don't think there was ever any doubt over which way this was going.
Right. So it's a bummer. You know, the first one was such a success and such a good movie, but hopefully it'll work out well for everyone involved. Tim Miller gets to make movies his way, and Reynolds gets to make the Deadpool movie the way he wants to make it.
And the important thing is, it's not just you know, Ryan Reynolds staying on. The original screenwriters are staying on as well. And I would argue that script was as important as any other element in that movie's success. So while I'll agree it's a little bit concerning, I am I am not all doom and gloom on the prospects of Deadpool 2 just yet.
Agreed. Let's move on over. And what do we have next up on the agenda, Nick?
Well, let's actually move it over to the world of comics for just a minute, where we, this past week, you know, last week we talked to you about the announcement of, I believe it was, Iceman and Weapon X, as part of the Resurrection branding. Well, this week we got a slew of X-Men announcements, to include a Cable solo title, a Jean Grey solo title, a new Generation X title, and most importantly, not one, but two new X-Men titles in a nod to the 1990s days, the golden era of the X-Men, some would consider it. We are getting X-Men Blue and X-Men Gold, both as ongoing titles, reviving the concept of the split team with different rosters across two different titles, which I know is something that speaks directly to your 90s X-Fan heart.
It certainly does. First of all, allow me to say, Gene! And second of all, allow me to say, holy crap, I'm excited about this.
Are you actually going to buy a Marvel book for once?
Well, that we'll see. We'll see how that
no,
goes.
No, you won't, because the first issue will cost $4.99.
$4.99. I'm not gonna pay $4.99 for it. I can tell you that. But what I will do is it gets me really excited about the trades, and there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing. Believe it. Regardless of what fuels, like Nick Duke would have people out there believe, there is no shame in waiting on the trade, folks. It's how I read comics for many, many years, and I actually prefer reading comics that way. But I have people in my life like Nick Duke who would spoil everything for me if I was waiting on the trade for Soyton books.
I'm going to spoil you? What have I spoiled you on?
Whatever weekly books you're reading that I'm not reading.
Like what? Name one.
Well, right now you're not reading any books that I'm not reading weekly.
That's not true.
Well, except for the Marvel stuff. But I, you know, all that stuff. You talk about plot details and all that. But anyway, no, I am very interested in the trades for this because this is a concept that, as you mentioned, speaks to my 90s X-Fan heart. It feels like everything old is new again. It feels like it's the 90s all over. And while a lot of people roll their eyes in comic book circles when you talk about the 90s, I do not. And especially when it comes
– especially the early 90s, which is what this is seeming to be pulling from.
Right. And this is my sweet spot for the X-Men. For some people, it's the 80s. For some people, it's the 70s X-Men. For me, it's that early 90s X-Men. It's my sweet spot, the blue and the gold teams, classic Jim Lee, Chris Claremont era of X-Men for me and kids of my generation. We remember the gold team led by Storm, the blue team led by Cyclops. Granted, the blue team was cooler. I mean, let's face it. But the gold team had their fair share of cool characters as well. And, you know, it's just time. It is time for the X-Men to reclaim their rightful role as the team in the Marvel Universe. And this is a chance to consolidate them back together. And I love what the editors have said in their interviews regarding this, about how for years the X-Men titles have been mired in this depressing extinction idea. Going all the way back, almost 10 – you realize it's been almost 10 years.
Back to House of M. It's been that
way.
Yeah,
so it's been 11 years. I mean, House of M was 05, I believe.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
And we're
House
going
of M, 11. Wait a minute. House of M was probably – no, yeah, you're right. 05, yeah.
Yeah. We're going on 11 years now of the X-Men being – the mutants being on the verge of extinction. And this is a chance to get the X-Men back – to having adventures again, to reminding people why they became fans of these characters in the first place. And it's the great diverse cast of characters. It's the fact that everyone's got an X-Man that they can relate to. That's their X-Man on the team.
Right, and that's something that they seem to be emphasizing, because in recent years, it's largely been X-Men or X-Men team books, and it's just, you know, the X-Men, the Extraordinary X-Men, the Uncanny X-Men, whatever. But this seems like a renewed focus. I can't remember ever a time where they've had as many X-Men solo books. I mean, they're going to have Iceman, Cable, Jean Grey, Weapon X, which I know isn't a solo book, but stick with me, and Generation X all running simultaneously. Again, it really feels like the X-Men franchise as a whole is getting a renewed, a fresh coat of paint and a renewed a level of importance when it comes to the Marvel editorial decision making.
And let's hope. And let's hope that, that the creative teams reflect that. And let's hope that we get, you know, Generation X, that can go in a number of directions. It could be the teen book, which a lot of people are expecting. It could possibly be a book about the characters who were in the original Generation X, aged up a little bit. Don't know yet. But Blue and Gold, awesome. A Jean Grey book should be really interesting. Iceman, Cable. It looks like after several years of being shunted aside, perhaps the X-Men fandom is starting to catch fire again. Hopefully, we'll see how the Inhumans event turns out and see what shakes out of that. But an exciting announcement, nonetheless.
Absolutely. And with that in mind, let's keep it at least tangentially X-Men related and talk about, you know, this past week we got two different trailers released for two upcoming big screen superhero adaptations. Let's talk about the X-Men related one first, as the first trailer for the third Wolverine solo outing, simply titled Logan, dropped this week, and holy crap.
Yeah, this sort of took the internet by storm when it dropped last week. Storm, get it?
And anyway, Not for any of the reasons that a superhero movie trailer normally would. It wasn't for quippy dialogue. It wasn't for mind-blowing action scenes. It was almost entirely because of the emotion displayed in the trailer and a tone that seems genuinely unlike anything we have ever seen in a superhero movie, in my opinion.
I agree. This feels – we talked about this, this is not an original concept. I've seen this elsewhere online. This feels like the Unforgiven of superhero movies.
Yep.
Based on the trailer. I mean, you've got the Johnny Cash song Hurt used to
– perfection.
Perfection, as it often is, but in this case, just perfect. You've got an aged, close-to-death Charles Xavier. You've got an aged, scarred, beaten down, broken Wolverine, a Wolverine who appears to be without any hope in the world. It very much feels like Clint Eastwood directing a Wolverine movie, which is appropriate in many ways. This is James Mangold, of course, coming back to direct again after he did the criminally underrated second Wolverine movie. But this just – you're right. The tone of this, the mood of this, and the emotion of this trailer – took the internet by storm last week and caught people off guard who weren't expecting much from this movie. I was expecting much from this movie, and it caught me off guard. So, this was – we really, really shot this movie up my list of anticipated films for next year. I'm really excited about this.
And the great thing is it isn't that far away. I mean, March, it will be here before we know it. I mean, it is – you know, it's right around the corner, man. It's right around the corner. So it looks to be a very high quality opening salvo in a loaded and absolutely stacked 2017 for superhero movies.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm already preparing for this movie to drag me through the emotional ringer. My emotional attachment to Wolverine, and particularly Hugh Jackman's portrayal of Wolverine, is such that I'm already preparing to be dragged through the emotional ringer.
Absolutely. But you know, we mentioned a stack 2017, and we got a first look at another 2017 film property, this one being Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 dropped its first trailer last week. Now, this one didn't show as much as the Logan trailer. It essentially brought back the hooked on a feeling, bat motif from the first few trailers for the first Guardians of the Galaxy movie. Like I said, didn't show a ton, only one little exchange of dialogue, but still, it's a good little refresher on who the Guardians are, kind of what the tone of this franchise is. I like this trailer, Greg.
Me too. If it dropped on any other day or on any other week, it would have been the buzz coming out of it, but Logan kind of took a lot of its thunder. But I thought this was great. I really enjoyed it. The interactions between Star-Lord and Drax the Destroyer, played by our good buddy Dave Bautista, was terrific and right in line.
And Greg, now what do we say when we're excited about something that Mr. Bautista has done?
Dave Bautista.
There we go.
And yeah, it was just an outstanding usage of humor, great conversation between the two characters, and a terrific trailer all around. I thought the great usage of the general idea that Guardians of the Galaxy is what it is, and it's not going to apologize for what it is. It's not going to try to be more than what it is. It is an action comedy that emphasizes the comedy over the action.
Are you suggesting, Greg, that your mentor Bobby Pierce might have had something to say about Guardians of the Galaxy?
Well, it's like my mentor Bobby Pierce once said, it is
what it is.
What it is. But the right, the trailer was fantastic.
Yeah, I agree. You know, not much else to say. I think you said it perfect, Pubba. So let's move on to the final story of the rundown for this week, and it is by far the one that Greg and I are the least qualified to talk about because it deals with complex financial terms, stock prices, and things we generally do not understand.
Bull and bear markets.
Greg, tell the people about the financial deal in the works.
Oh, great. You're gonna throw it to me on this one. No, that's...
Hey, you took the first two. I took the next two. Now I'm tossing back to you, sir.
Well, as everyone knows, as I turned into Vince Russo on a podcast, Steve, let me explain it like this, Steve. As anyone knows that follows the industry, Time Warner / Warner Brothers owns DC Comics.
Yes.
That's how this is related to comic books. Well,
they also own, for the record, Warner Brothers Studios, and then as well cable networks, HBO, CNN, TNT, TBS, Cartoon Network, there are various others, Boomerang. Lots of different entertainment properties that Time Warner has their hands on, as well as Time Magazine on the publishing side, tons of various media conglomerates that are almost too many to name.
Almost anything that Ted Turner once owned is now owned by Time Warner. Well, almost. which we'll get to in a moment. But all that being said, media conglomerate. And stop me if you've heard the term conglomerate before. AT&T, according to the trade publications that both Nick and I subscribe to, of course, mm-hmm. because we're high rollers in the financial community, as everyone knows, AT&T made a tentative agreement to purchase Time Warner Inc. for a measly sum, $85 billion. Which, to my knowledge, is an amount of money that doesn't even exist. But they purchased it, or they are agreeing to purchase it for $85 billion, which is a deal that apparently could be finalized by the time you hear this podcast. So now,
granted, this still has to go through some federal regulators who have to approve it for various antitrust. Nomenclature and technicalities.
It's all a bit technical.
It's all a bit technical, but the important thing is that Time Warner's future is secure.
Right. That's right. Yeah, didn't you get the memo? AT&T, what are they going to do with Time Warner? What are they going to do with Time Warner's subsidiaries? No one knows. I mean, this is all up in the air. We mentioned this because it was worth talking about because it does affect DC Comics the same way that Disney buying.
If I may hazard a guess, Greg, at least part of the motivation.
Mr. Duke has a what he has termed himself a crazy fan theory So let's hear it, Nate.
Judging by some of the articles I've read, AT&T's recent pattern of behavior, especially with their acquisition of DirecTV in 2015, has led people to believe that they are in the process of trying to acquire companies that could provide them with essentially in-house content that can be streamed or downloaded to mobile devices. You know, content, you know, whether it was would be a CNN app or an HBO app or something like that, that they could attractively package to consumers on, you know, their mobile, their phones, their tablets, their what have yous. Essentially, AT&T able to keep all of their, you know, the cost it takes to download and upload and all that kind of stuff in-house, so that essentially they are not having to invest in network infrastructure that is being used to download properties they don't have a stock in. I say all that to say this. I would think that their interest in buying Time Warner is largely due to HBO, CNN, the various television properties. But here's how it could potentially affect the comics world. If the idea is to create more mobile content, to create more content that can be pushed to mobile devices, could we finally, maybe, for the love of God, get a DC Comics Online unlimited subscription service?
Would you like me to?
Quite frankly, it's not for us to say.
Right. I was going to say, do you want me to answer that? Because not for us to say, quite frankly. That's not we're not the one to make that decision. Who's to say, really?
Who's to say? But I will say, one other thing I want to say is, I think you and I both would agree that when it comes to big time money making, HBO, CNN, the television properties, Warner Brothers as a movie studio, is just on a higher level of DC Comics publishing. You know, comics publishing is profitable, but it isn't going to, you know, really impact the bottom line of something like right. AT&T that is throwing around $85 billion for a purchase. So my concern here isn't necessarily for DC Comics, but I do have something of a concern for DC Comics films, because if we have another entity now in charge of Warner Brothers, who's to say they won't be shaking up their entire movie-making strategies over the next few years?
Shaking things up a bit.
So I'm kind of interested to see if new leadership, new ideas might not have some sort of impact on the DC Extended Universe as we go forward.
Yes. Hopefully, I think the best case scenario for us right now would be what you just outlined, having that DC Unlimited online unlimited subscription service, which could then sponsor future fantasy drafts.
Indeed.
But then again, as we've seen in the past, sometimes when big conglomerates purchase things from smaller conglomerates or owners, things don't turn out too well. And, you know, for instance, Time Warner, I'm not going to be shedding any tears for you as a company for being bought out by AT&T, because you bastards, you indirectly or directly killed two things very near and dear to my heart, that being World Championship Wrestling, of course, and the Atlanta Braves. So thanks for that.
You rat bastards.
That's right.
Can AT&T buy Liberty Media? Is that a possibility?
That would be amazing. Or buy Liberty Media, close all the television networks, and just invest all of the money into the Atlanta Braves payroll, and just allow them to buy all the players.
Yes. I agree with this. I agree with this wholeheartedly.
That would work good for me. So, in any event, folks, that brings us to an end of the rundown, and we are now coming to the end of the episode. Tell the good folks at home, Nick, what they can expect in the coming weeks from us.
Well, we have, you know, with this episode, the first half of this episode, we have officially tied a bow, brought an end to Walking Dead month. So we're going to be back on our normal rotation next month. And we will kick that all off next week as we go off the page. You know, Marvel Studios is preparing to release the Doctor Strange live-action theatrical movie. But this isn't the first Doctor Strange movie to be made. So we're going to be going back and taking a look at the direct-to-DVD animated Doctor Strange feature for Off the Page next week. The following week is... That's Long Book Hunters, if I'm not mistaken. Greg, is that correct?
I believe that is the case, yes.
No, it is not. I'm sorry. The following week is Hard Travelers for Hire, as we will be bringing that new segment back for the second installment. We took a look at 2008's Iron Man the first time out. Now we're going to be taking a look at 2008's The Incredible Hulk, and we will be joined by special guest of the Sellers Point podcast, Russell Sellers, to go take a look back at that film and see how it stacks up in hindsight.
Yep.
The following week, we will be, as I mistakenly said a moment ago, going on a long book hunt, as we mentioned earlier, on the late, great Steve Dillon's Welcome Home, Frank Castle storyline for The Punisher. And then, of course, to wrap up the month of November, we will have our countdown with Ben Morse of Marvel.com. Ben Morse, and he will be dropping by to count down the top five Marvel video games of all time. And of course, you know, all the shows in November are important. And we're going to bring you some great stuff in November. Make no mistake about it. But the stuff in November is the appetizer. It's a little taste. It's a little tease for what we have coming up the first week of December.
And that is, of course, the largest podcast ever in Place to Be Nation pop history. That's right, folks. We are going to be giving you, again, the largest podcast ever in Place to Be Nation pop history, because we are going to be going off the page. And we are going to be examining a movie that is going to rock your world. And we will provide you with all the content you need to view it.
Yes, we will. Well, we'll provide you with as much content as we possibly can, not to give too much away. You know, last week we teased you a little bit. We told you it has to do with the world of YouTube fan films. I will drop another little hint this week and tell you it has to do with a YouTube fan film that is adapting a Vertigo project.
That's right, folks. And this is, I mean, listen, we've had some great guests. We've had some great episodes. We have some great guests planned for the future that we haven't even talked about yet, because we're still negotiating right now. But I still...
Yes, and that's actually true. We are in active negotiations with a fairly high profile guest, and that's no bullshit right there. That's real. That's a shoot, brother.
But all of that, I mean, none of it can compare to the largest podcast ever in Place to Be Nation pop history. So be on the lookout for that. Be on the lookout to some really cool content. We got some game changing content potentially coming your way in the coming months here. And as always, for Nick, I have to thank all of you people out there for listening, for hanging with us, for giving us your feedback. We love your feedback. Keep bringing it. Keep sending it in. Let us know what we can do different, what we can do the same, what you like, what you don't like. Send us your list for countdown, for God's sake. Anything else you need to send out to the people before we sign off here, Nick?
Not that I can think of. As always, you know, we welcome your feedback. You got all that info, our respective the ways you can reach out to each of us. We gave that to you in the first half of the show, but in the meantime, don't forget about all the other great shows here on the Place to Be Nation pop feed. I know the NBA season has just started back, so we have the NBA team moved over with Andrew Reich and Adam Murray. So we got a little sports content now over here on the pop feed, in addition to all the stuff that was here before. Of course, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Lucha Undead, Imaginary Stories, Sellers Points, Geek and Sassy, the the Haley's Comet-esque conversation comics that comes around once every you know, millennia or so. Just a lot of great content around here on the feed.
Absolutely. And one last note to all the Walking Dead fans who stuck around through Walking Dead Month. We really appreciate it. We think this has been a success for us. Hope you've all enjoyed it and tuned into the premiere and enjoyed that, hopefully. And the last thought I want to leave you on for Walking Dead Month is that it relates to a character, Shane Walsh, who gone but not forgotten. And basically my message to everyone out there who has hated on Shane for years, Shane wasn't a monster. He was just ahead of the curve.
I thought you were going to say, go on, take it, girl.
Well, I wanted to work in that Joker quote, but that's a good one too, Nick. That's a good one too. Which also relates to certain people in Geneva. But that's a story for off the air. In any event, we hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll catch you next week when we go off the page to look at Doctor Strange.
Beat on the brat with the baseball bat. Oh yeah, oh ho. Beat on the brat with the baseball bat. Oh yeah, oh ho. Oh yeah, oh ho. A brat like that, though, it's on your mom. What can you learn? What can you do? What can you do? With a brat like that, though, it's on your mom. What can you learn? Learn. Beat on the brat with the baseball bat. Oh yeah, oh ho. Beat on the brat with the baseball bat. Oh yeah, oh ho. Oh yeah.